There's only so much you can test until you just shove it in front of, a million plus people and say, go at it.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of SteamClock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Kristen Borneman. Kristen is the development director on the critically acclaimed MMO Guild Wars 2. Hi, Kristen.
Hello.
We're excited to have you.
Ah, thank you.
So our topic today is going to be scaling multiplayer online games and hopefully some of the horror stories that we have either, maybe not personally experienced as the people who are scaling them, but the people playing them and all the many stories out there about what makes this so hard. So we're far enough along the history of online games that you would think that we as an industry had figured this out. You launch a big game, it's really hyped, we know a lot of people are going to want to play it. And so all the servers should just work, right?
That is a can of worms.
So obviously I'm like poking the can of worms a little bit because Kristen's the one who actually works at a game company that has a bajillion players playing a game simultaneously online. And it's easy for me making web pages where it's just, and apps where just you're displaying content as opposed to necessarily having everyone interact with each other all at once. But at a high level, do you want to take a stab at sort of why is scaling an online game so much harder than most other things?
Yeah, it's funny when you gave the intro, actually, my brain went straight back to launch 2 years ago, and I was having sort of heart palpitations thinking about that time. We launched at midnight, so we had a grand party. It was fun. We were toasting, and then all of the programmers, and I was in charge of basically the gameplay programming department at that time, and I ran back to my desk with all of the programmers and went back to work. But why is it so hard? I think ultimately at the core of that question is there some things that you can only run through, or there are only certain scenarios that you can hit when you're actually doing it. And I think that's really the core, is you can run through as many scenarios in your head as to what you think is going to happen. You can think that you've asked all the right questions, but it's really hard to run through every single scenario when you have something that complex and that complicated that you're trying to build.
So there's kind of two fundamental categories of problems when you're trying to scale something that things will fall over. The simple one is just you didn't predict the number of players or the number of users well enough.
Right.
And so we can cover that one pretty quickly because it's just the prediction and math, which, you can say, okay, our previous game had this many players, and we can look at launches of other games. And sometimes even then people have a hard time. So there's this MMO that you linked to Arcage.
Yeah, it just launched.
It just launched. And apparently their problem, which is a good problem to have, is that they've had way more players than they expected. And this is, they admit this clearly, like, and of course, everyone who has server demand server problems is going to say, oh, due to an unanticipated demand or, best sales ever or whatever. That's why. It's not because we had a bug or anything. It's always because the demand is way more than forecast. And that normally is to some degree part of the problem. But these, in this article, and we'll link it up in the show notes, they're saying that they had four contingency plans for getting more signups than they expected, and they pulled off the fourth one, which is like, massive piles of servers being shipped completely emergency, with all speed possible to be set up in racks and racks and racks to add capacity.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that article is really the detail that Scott Hartzman gives on what is going on there. I mean, really, I think there's actually like this whole thing of can we predict how many players are going to log on day one? Like, it's one of those things that it's not hard. It's just sort of insidious when it comes down to are you going to spend the money once you know that it's going to be X amount of players? And the thing in this article is that they basically say we knew that it was going to be a lot and we didn't want to spend the money. Which I thought was very honest. Like, if you really look at what he says, that's basically what he was saying. He's like, I wish it would be different, but no, sorry, we just didn't spend the money to do that.
And he also talks about how when you see that spike, and this is something that has, like, it's not just in game server scaling, but in other problems where you can overshoot and cause yourself serious problems. So there's MMOs and other games where they launch and then they see this huge demand. And so they order 20 times as many servers. And then, of course, always day one demand is going to be sort of your biggest spike. And then it's going to have some curve. And you don't know what that curve is. And so you can easily have truckloads and truckloads of servers coming that you're paying millions and millions of dollars. And he mentioned in the article, well, we spent millions, but we were too cautious to spend tens of millions. And you could easily imagine having a game where then you get an extra millions or tens of millions of dollars of servers, and then you can't afford to keep them running as it, you know, sort of curves off to a sustainable number of players.
Right. I think specifically in that instance, they're talking about opening up worlds, correct? So they don't want to open up too many worlds. Otherwise, the worlds become empty and then you have no one to fill those worlds, and your game feels like a dead game.
And that's a huge problem in MMOs that you just don't have in other scaling scenarios, right? Like, it's easy for a web service to just say, eh, screw it. You know, we've got a whole bunch of VC capital that we got to burn through, and might as well over-provision our servers just in case. And nothing bad's going to happen because of the servers being over-provisioned, but when you're dealing with a game that's sharded, which I think virtually all MMOs these days are, where you've got different disconnected worlds that people are playing on, and you know you're only going to see the people on your world. Yeah, you can have the most successful service of all time and have it still be a ghost town if you over-provisioned it, because everyone's only going to be seeing the people on their shard, and likely your load balancing system is not gonna, you know, is not necessarily gonna be set up to handle that in a way that players are assigned to, you know, people are gonna be assigned a server based on geographic proximity or some other metric, not necessarily, oh, we want to fill up one server first so everyone there is getting the full experience and leave other ones completely empty until we need them.
Exactly. It's actually, I mean, we do things a little bit differently on Guild Wars 2. So this problem is solved, honestly. Maybe not perfectly design-wise, but technologically-wise, there are ways to scale this so that you can sort of scale individually or independently of worlds. So on Guild Wars 2, we have the overflow system, which means we're spinning up instances of maps on a given, actually what we have is virtual shards. We don't have a shard per, let's say, blade or a couple shards on a blades that are actually independent of the actual hardware in the data center. So we have a map. That map can have as many versions of it as we could possibly want. And if you can't get into the map that has all the people from your world on it, well, and we'll get into that, worlds don't really exist in Guild Wars 2 anymore. But if you can't get into the map of your world, then you just go into an overflow and you're with other people who couldn't get into the map that they wanted to get into. And then they're in a queuing system. So if you really want to go back to your original map, you're sort of queued, but you can still play the game and you're still in the version, you're in the map, you're just in a different version of it.
So if you are not paying much attention and you're not playing with anyone else that you know, then you just wander to this, you know, go down by the lake, and then it might happen that you're playing with people who aren't on your quote-unquote, what it would be called in World of Warcraft, a server.
You
think of yourself as like, oh, I have an account on this server and I play with people on this server. But if something is overpopulated, then you could just go down there and it turns out right now you're not playing with other people on your server. And it doesn't really matter as long as you don't have someone else who's on your server trying to meet you down by the lake.
Exactly. And then it's about putting in the design infrastructure for you to allow you to meet up with that friend that you're grouped with, even if you end up on different worlds or different versions of the world. So it then becomes more of a design problem rather than a tech limit. And it actually allowed us, like, the main thing I was reading about with ArcheAge is ridiculous queue times. So we had no queues going into Guild Wars 2 at launch. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
So for anyone who is not an MMO vet, or I guess pretty much any online game nowadays will have this idea, but this is basically the servers nowadays know to only accept people to a certain point because they'll melt. And so you just wait in line to join the server after a certain point. And so you're saying at launch, you didn't have any queues, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it's mostly in the old, well, and I say old, but ArcheAge just did this, but you have X amount of people that can be on Y world for, you know, in order for it to be a good experience. And at some point they cap it and then you queue for your specific world to get in and play. And that's not the case because worlds are pretty much arbitrary in Guild Wars 2. And now they're even more arbitrary because we got rid of them.
That's awesome.
Is that a tech decision you guys sort of specifically made up front to deal with that problem? Or was it something you had to retrofit into the system to deal with practical consequences once you got traction?
Absolutely. It was something that was built into Guild Wars 2. I think it was even at least the foundation of that was built into Guild Wars 1.
So that's something that basically, I mean, I haven't heard of that in other games, but you, in your world, that's sort of the modern way of doing it. But has that propagated itself to other similar games, or are you just on the cutting edge as far as you know?
I mean, a lot of these games, and ArcheAge has probably been in development for as long as Guild Wars 2 was. Guild Wars 2 was in development for 6 years, I believe. So it's going to take some time, especially in the MMO world. And who even knows? So what it comes to the basic question of what is an MMO these days? Is Sims Online an MMO? Because that experienced huge issues when it initially launched. Is GTA 5 an MMO for its online component? And I think eventually, as more and more games have an online component, I fully expect this to be utilized.
Yeah, and then obviously Grand Theft Auto and especially The Sims had these serious queuing problems and things like that. And so I imagine there's a very large number of people out in the world planning future game launches, thinking about this problem we're talking about, which is how do we scale games and have less pain for players? Because it's something that has started to, I've noticed in the last couple of years, as games have gotten more and more online and more games are getting MMO type features, that the launch and problems that historically plagued MMOs are bleeding across into first-person shooters and, you know, sim games and things that really have no right to, or like people have no patience or expectation that they're not going to be able to launch their city building game because a lot of other people also want to play the city building game at the same time.
Well, wasn't that the huge kerfuffle with the latest SimCity, right? That it required a bunch of online stuff that was all overloaded, even for single-player play. Like, it wasn't even just, oh, it had a multiplayer component, you couldn't play the multiplayer component. It was, yeah, the single-player game is totally borked as long as the servers are screwed up.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about it was at the time, of course, EA was saying, well, it is a fundamentally online game. We couldn't possibly make it fully single player. But then after enough backlash and server problems, they ended up just making it single player.
You know, there's a part of me that I've, you know, EA you know, world's most hated games company or company in the world or whatever it is. But I have sympathy for them in the Sims case. I think, you know, what they didn't expect everybody, you know, it goes back to the basic problem where, you know, they didn't have, and I think in EA's particular case, they didn't have the expertise in-house to understand what they were getting into. And this goes basically back to what we were saying, which is as more of these more games and more of these companies switch to live supported games that are massively multiplayer, they're going to have to learn how to deal with these problems. And I think right now they're looking at old school MMOs as to how they solve these problems, which is why we end up with queues and things like that. But eventually they're going to figure out that there is a better way to do this.
So other than the sort of, you sort of mentioned the fact that the concept of worlds don't exist anymore in Guild Wars 2, but what sort of things do you think that they can learn, or what would you say are the techniques that you use kind of at a high level that are better than queues?
I think what we have in the background, now that we've gotten rid of worlds, so you can already tell that my describing of overflows and our system, worlds are already antiquated. There's no reason. If you have an algorithm in the background that can, I will air quote, smartly pair people together with their social groups, then you don't really need worlds at all. All you can do is pair people. And then if somebody wants to pair with a different friend that you didn't want to, that you didn't expect, you just have to give them the mechanisms in order to do that. And so once we realized that, that was sort of the philosophy. Guild Wars 2 is very much a, you can play the game however you want it, and sort of our server infrastructure is sort of the same way. Like, they want to be fluid and flexible, and I think getting rid of worlds is very much headed in that direction. And instead, we would rather have things smartly guiding you in the background to make smart decisions for you.
That's interesting that you mentioned the social group thing, because you have in the game that not only, like, you know, an idea of who's in my guild, but also like who's in my friends list and like who do I play with, and maybe even like who's on my Facebook. I'm not sure how much data you have, right? But it had not occurred to me that you could probably just dynamically not just allocate people permanently based on who their friend group is, which is the way World of Warcraft has always done it, but like dynamically say, okay, well, no one of Alan's family is online, and then Dad logs in and he gets put into this sort of instance. And so when I log in, put me in the same one that Dad's in, because you statistically know that I'm almost always going to play with him if he's online.
Exactly. And in our game, it very much spawns up random pug groups, pickup groups. So I know if I've been playing with this person in this map for a long time and we've been chatting, or maybe we are not even friends, and maybe we didn't even form a party, but if we go into the next map, keep those two people together.
Yeah, and that's just common sense. And also gives you that sense of continuity that it feels like the world, because that's one of the big challenges with, maybe obviously, but one of the big challenges with something where you have, 3 or 4 million people play Guild Wars 2? Is that roughly the number?
Yes, yeah.
And so if you have, you know, obviously not all simultaneously, but you have millions of people playing this game, and you need to try to give a sense for any given person that they're in a coherent world, even though there is no coherent world at all.
Exactly. That absolutely is the main challenge, is how do you make it feel like there is some world construct, so that you're seeing the same people and you're interacting with the people that you do without having the hard construct that is worlds.
And Journey, which I will always bring up in any game discussion, it'll come back to Journey somehow, did this in a way that you were playing through the game and other people who were playing with you would appear and disappear, but they looked the same, basically. So if you didn't know any better, you'd be like, oh yeah, there's the guy again, except it may be someone different. But if your game is done any remotely successful character design, then the people who you're playing with will not be interchangeable visually. So
probably not. Not in most MMOs. Journey, I mean, they did a fantastic job of pairing the design of that game with what they did technically. I think it's the perfect example of that.
So your model on Guild Wars 2 is a little bit different, or definitely different than the traditional MMO model of, okay, you have a subscription and you pay Blizzard however much a month. Whereas Guild Wars 2 is an upfront purchase for the game, and then there's some in-game things that you can sort of purchase ongoingly if you want, but people may have bought the game on launch and they're still playing, you know, 10 or realistically, there's probably some people playing 40 hours a week or more on your server infrastructure without giving you any additional revenue. Is there anything specific, or sort of, is it just become maybe a different prioritization for making things run efficiently when you're running a system like that?
I think there's sort of two things that go into this. One is the general design philosophy of a no subscription based game, which is we want you to come back whenever is convenient for you. And so it's very interesting. And because we don't have necessarily the gear grind that traditional MMOs have, players feel like they can come back after a month, 2 months, or whenever is convenient to come back for them. But I think on technically, I think you have to compare yourself to games that are not subscription-based. I think so when you're doing projections, when you're thinking about how many people are going to enter your game, you have to really think about, this is not a traditional MMO, so I'm not going to look at the traditional MMO sales because I'm going to realize that we're bringing in a different type of player than plays ArcheAge, for example, or World of Warcraft. And we really are. We've found that our players are a very different player than, you know, somebody else who is really into hardcore raiding, for example. So are there any special pressures? I mean, just in terms of how you think about your game, you need to treat your game a little bit differently.
I guess there's a side topic, which I think is interesting, because I was reading a little bit about how you ship updates very frequently.
Yeah.
So every 2 weeks, is that crazy?
Yeah, it is. I think our studio is, say, 300 plus people, and most of the people are working on Guild Wars 2. So that's a lot of people pushing out bi-weekly content for our players. I think it's also huge value for our players. Like you said, no subscription required, and we're pushing out big, huge content updates every 2 weeks.
Yeah, when you've got like more than 100 people building content every 2 weeks, launching new content to all these people who are not paying you necessarily any ongoing, like, it seems too good to be true.
Well, and the other thing that I found kind of interesting about that is Guild Wars seems to have avoided the temptation that the ongoing microtransaction in-app purchasey kind of stuff in other games seems to often fall prey to, of warping the game design around the transactions. Like they seem to have followed kind of the hat model, right? Of that a lot of the microtransaction purchases are focused on visuals as much as they are on functionality. So it's one of those things where it seems like you guys are real outliers in terms of how you're, that all of the elements of your subscription model and payment model seem to be the opposite of what other people's in, to making the same sort of design decisions you guys are, but it seems to be working out for you, which I think is kind of interesting.
It is, and I wish more people would do it. I think there's a lot of talk in the backlash to sort of free-to-play mobile games that, a lot of people fully accept that what's happening in the free-to-play arena is unacceptable, but then it's hard to know how exactly to enact that on the other side. And I think we just want to give the best value proposition to our players, right? Which is, we're going to continue to make this awesome game and make it better for you as long as you continue to log in, and not you continue to log in every single week, because otherwise you're going to worry about being behind a month later, but that, you log in, say hi to us every once in a while. And that's really the core philosophy about, you know, what we're trying to do on Guild Wars 2. I mean, not to get too marketing speech, because I'm totally not a marketing person at all, but I think it's a really unique game when you think about what else is going on in the industry and what we've been able to be successful doing.
Yeah, and it definitely makes me more interested as someone who I still kind of call it, just like, you know, for various other things you can get dependent on, I think of myself as a recovering WoW addict, even though I haven't played in years now. And so I haven't actually played any MMORPG type games since then. Guild Wars, I was going to play it before. It turns out the game is like 20 gigabytes, so that takes more than 3 hours to download. But
yes,
I like set up the installer and like downloaded in like 10 minutes. I was like, oh my God, this is really cool. But no, that's the downloader downloaded in 10 minutes.
Yes. And then
but I'm like halfway through the download. It's going pretty well, and I'm like investigating character creation and stuff like that. But the more I've read about it, I mean, obviously it's critically well reviewed, which is good. But that philosophy has come through not just in the marketing materials, but also the way that people talk about the game. It's not just all about how can you grind through the first 80 levels, or they're probably up to 90 or 100 now. In WoW, how can you grind through the sort of boring content so you can get to the real content, which is the end game rating of having 25 people that need to meet 3 times a week in order to try and finally grind enough gear in order to, like, that treadmill behavior, which the treadmill game design, I just realized we're getting way off topic, but the treadmill game design is rational when you need to have a subscription, because if you don't have a treadmill for people to go on, then they're going to rightfully complain, I'm paying you a monthly subscription, like, but there's not enough things to grind through. And so the business model that you attach yourself to benefits, or at least gives you the leeway to potentially benefit the game design that way.
Yeah, and I think the way I like to think about it is more of a virtuous cycle. Like, we'll respect our players and they'll respect us back. And it manifests itself in so many ways. This is going to sound really silly, but we have seriously the nicest players, and they are so friendly and so helpful. And I can run around in our game with my ArenaNet tag, and everybody is super nice. Nobody yells at me. Everybody is really helpful. And I think that is the result of having this sort of respect for our player base in terms of how we not only set up our, you know, our business structure, but also how, you know, this bi-weekly updates that we do.
I have a bias, and I will really get us back up onto the scaling topic, but I have this bias or perception of games where there's a fair amount of customizability of the players in order to get into feeling like they have created a character and then therefore should act like a character, that you get better player behavior than you do if everyone is just a square-shouldered, square-headed soldier that all looks generically the same. You know what I mean? I'm not sure if there's any actual evidence of that, but I feel like that's like a positive. Because if you create a character, you know, maybe you create a character in your mind that they're a jerk, but people have a tendency to create a character that wants to make the world a better place or something, and then people are going to think of themselves that way when they're interacting in the game, which is a net win for sure.
Oh, that's so interesting. It makes me want to run studies on that stuff. I love it when people take systems like World of Warcraft and run like economy simulations as well and do all that sort of crazy stuff. I think they're great testing beds for sort of those theories.
Yeah, I'm inclined to. I feel like that would come out in the wash if you were to measure that. Let's fund that. Kickstart it.
All right, done.
So Guild Wars 2, it launched. You didn't even have queues, which is amazing, but it was not all perfect. Because you mentioned this, and I also kind of reading up about it, that at some point you had enough new people signing up that you actually stopped selling the game briefly, which is a very awesome move. Like, you're like, we're going to stop accepting new players and more money in order to shore the servers up. What was kind of what led up to that, and how did it go?
I think, like we said, and we've been talking about, we did have a system that could scale easily, but you know, there. Like I said, to start it off, there's only so much you can test until you just shove it in front of, you know, a million plus people and say, go at it. I think actually Mike O'Brien, our studio head, I was reading articles from this time because honestly, I don't want to say I've blocked it out, but I have tried hard to forget about all the sleepless nights. But I think Mike O'Brien, Mo as we called him, said we had over 400,000 concurrent users, and that was well above sort of what we had projected. And it was fine, but it was definitely testing the limits, and we were finding not necessarily holes in our fundamentals, but it was testing the bounds of other areas, which means like our commerce system was down for quite some time immediately after launch. So the trading post was unavailable until I think about a week after, maybe if you include head start time. And we were running really long hours trying to, it felt like at the time, trying to physically hold everything up by on our shoulders. I mean, all in all, our launch went smoothly. I mean, when I talk to people, especially when I talk to players, it's really funny. You get this warped sense. Like, I remember this as a completely catastrophic time when we couldn't do anything else. And I was, you know, everybody was running ragged. We were doing 24-hour shifts and crazy stuff like that. And then you talk to players and they're like, oh, yeah, you had a really good launch. And I'm like, don't you remember, like, you couldn't get into groups and things were acting weird? And they're like, yeah, I think I remember that, maybe. That
sounds vaguely familiar.
Maybe. I don't remember. But no, it was a good launch. And part of me is, it's frustrating. Part of that is frustrating because you put so much, you know, sort of blood, sweat, and tears into that. But part of that is... you know, it's good. It's good. It ended up looking a lot better on the outside than it did on the inside. And I suppose that's where the saying, you don't want to know how the meat is made. In a lot of ways, shipping an MMO is very much getting into the meat of what your game is worth.
There's a couple of sort of interesting like biases that might be at play there. One on the player's side, one on the developer's side, which is that from the player's standpoint, you know, if they're comparing it to anything at all, they're probably comparing it to the launch of other MMOs. And because MMOs frequently have disastrous launches, you know, maybe an MMO launch that's only a little rough actually seems pretty good. It, you know, it's not a situation like the SimCity launch that I mentioned before, where, you know, people are sort of feeling they're being ripped off by the servers being in crummy shape because it's something that shouldn't need that server technology. Everyone sort of knows that, like, yep, MMOs are complicated. They've got gnarly backends. They often fall over at launch. So they're just willing to cut people a little more slack there. On the developer side, I suspect that that one of the things that's going on there is that any successful launch almost by definition has to be hard, because if it's successful, you're going to get more players than you were expecting, right? Like, I'm sure there's all sorts of MMO launches where the servers have not been over capacity, and we're not talking to any of the people who worked on those games because those games folded and the companies went out of business. And so, you know, sort of by definition, if you're one of the ones that survived, you probably had to have a rough launch because otherwise you weren't over capacity and weren't really successful.
I think that's a very good point. I think for us, even though it obviously was successful for us and better than expected, but for us, again, this goes back to the virtuous cycle. The reason we turned off sales is we wanted to preserve the people who had already bought the game, their game experience. And that wasn't putting in a queuing system. That wasn't adding a whole bunch more worlds or doing something like that. That was turning off digital sales on our website. And really, tech-wise, that's really easy to do. You guys know web code. You just remove the buy button. But it was a really tough decision, sort of emotionally. And I think it was ultimately, I believe, the right decision, but it was definitely not something that we took lightly. And it was purely based on the fact of preserving the game experience for our current player base.
I feel like that category of decision ends up playing a lot better in the long term, even though people maybe complain about it. But if you look at launches of some things, even in the non-game space where they've queued, like when Gmail launched, and like, you're going to have a gigabyte of email storage, which at the time it was like, no, that's got to be an April Fool's. You couldn't have a gigabyte of mail storage, but it was like invite only. And they had this gating that they could only take a certain number of signups at the time. And a lot of other services have done that. And gating the rate at which new players join the world tends to, like, yeah, there's going to be some people who would have joined and then never bother, but it tends to have the people who are in speak positively about it. They have good experiences because the servers actually work. And then it ends up being a service that people continue to want to be on.
Well, I think ultimately people would be more pissed off if you let them buy the game and then the experience sucked, right? Like, if you go to buy the game and there's a thing saying, sorry, we're over capacity, we can't sell you this game right now, like, most people aren't going to get pissed off about that. Like you say, the worst case scenario is probably, oh, they don't buy the game and it never occurs to them again, and you've lost that sale. But the worst case scenario of letting them buy the game is that they have a crummy experience if the servers are overloaded. And that's, again, long run, that probably hurts your PR much more than closing sales ever would, I would think.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, definitely. So we know that it's hard to simulate. We know that it's hard to project how many people are going to play, but, you know, especially if you already previously have an existing fan base, you have pre-signups, people pre-order the game, you can do some math. But even if you have done that perfectly and you know the exact number of players who are going to be on for every given second and how many hours a day they're going to play and all of these sort of things, it's still hard to simulate how a player is going to behave. If you just write a dumb bot that just like walks around and will just pick up and drop items and will kill boars and then just like run that bot on your servers before launch and be like, all right, we can run a million bots of, or maybe we say 400,000 simultaneous players. We can run 400,000 boar killing bots. And then you open up the game and then there's 400,000 people who are doing completely different things. They're spending their whole time warping in between towns every 30 seconds, which causes, you know, the town loading server to be way more overloaded than the boar killing server. You know, I don't know, it's a silly example, but so I was reading a bit about this and actually found an article by Patrick Wyatt, who happens to be a founder of ArenaNet.
He is.
On scaling using or like doing load testing using recording and playback of actual player behavior, which I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, we actually didn't do this on Guild Wars 2. He's talking about the original Guild Wars system. But I think we take a lot of the philosophies of what they did in Guild Wars into Guild Wars 2. You know, what you explained right there is the reason why people do PTRs. There's only so much you can simulate. But actually, the effectiveness of PTRs is pretty, let's say, up for debate.
So for anyone who is not, who doesn't know what PTR is, it's a public test realm, or at least that's what it means in WoW. Is that the same?
Yes, yeah. It is a public test realm. Actually, in referring to it to somebody else, somebody was like, you can't refer to it as a public test realm because realms are WoW specific.
Are not a concept in WoW.
Yes, you have to a public test world or whatever is the MMO non-generic or non-specific MMO generic MMO term for that, but yeah, so to go back to the bot testing and the player recording player behavior and then playing it back, I think in order to find cheaters, actually a lot of what we did is allow for to understand if people were cheating is we recorded player behavior and then played it back to see if like that movement was feasible, for example, which I think is super interesting. All of our cheat detection and things like that, sometimes the ability to just watch somebody and be like, oh, they teleported way all the way over there, even though in the logging, I'm still getting that they are here. So somehow, somewhere, something's going wrong.
This is an entire, I think actually cheating and stuff like that could be a whole episode. I find it really fascinating because I wrote, I mean, it's fascinating on its own, but I wrote some online games when I was in college, and I wrote this web app that would make these assumptions like, okay, so if a player doesn't have enough money to send out an assassination strike on someone, it won't give them the button that says send out assassination strike. But the server never checked that they had enough money. So if you wrote a script, then you could actually just have the script ping the server that says assassinate this guy, assassinate this guy, assassinate this guy. And the server would be like, well, he wouldn't have the button if he didn't have enough money. So I guess he must be able to do it. And then someone found that. And then
yes,
that's sort of the fundamental conflict of any multiplayer game, like not even MMOs or anything, is that fundamentally what you want is you want to put absolutely no trust whatsoever in the client, right? You want the client to like ship key presses to the server, and the server ships back like rendered video frames and an audio stream, you know, like on live style, completely streaming gaming. But of course, that's impractical from a performance standpoint. In order to get performance, you need to trust the client on some stuff, and everything you trust the client on is a hole that that nefarious people will exploit as much as they possibly can.
So this sort of general philosophy of not being able to trust the client, as you mentioned, ends up being a substantial amount of work for the development team. Just general category of bad behavior. There's the, you know, having a hacked client that reports unreasonable things, like you just tell the server, all right, I move to position X, comma Y. This is where I am. And then if the server doesn't go, wait a minute, that means you're running at 1,000 kilometers an hour right now. I'm going to boot you or ban you. Then it just updates. And then there's also, especially when you get into in-game economies, people trying to do like timing attacks where they can sell an item twice or manipulate the market or things like that. I know that in Diablo 3, you mentioned that in Guild Wars, that the economy or the trading system was down for quite some time when the game launched, and you're working on scaling that. Apparently in Diablo 3, or when it was launching, it had some of the same problems, and apparently they were reporting that the majority of traffic to the part of the game that was running the auction house was not even authentic traffic of real people trying to play the game. It was gold miners and or gold farmers, I should say, and just people writing malicious scripts trying to buy and sell things like high frequency trading and things like that.
Wow. That, I think that's the fear of every developer ever that is writing an online game, is that, you know, at some point you have more people interacting with a certain part of your game that are not legitimate people. They are instead, you know, bots or people running a whole bunch of side accounts or, you know, doing nefarious behavior instead of actual player behavior.
I saw one player back in the day in World of Warcraft, and I was just going around and I saw four shamans all walking in sync, walking through the desert, and they would walk along and then they would all attack the same thing exactly simultaneously. Their wands are in sync. They're casting the same spell. Their hands are moving at the same time. I'm like, oh, this guy's cheating. And sort of like trying to mention it to some people. And then looking into it a little bit more, it's like, well, they don't actually really care about that because he actually has four subscriptions, one for each character. And they're just all, one computer controls them all, but he's paying for them all. So they didn't care.
Oh, I was going to say a funny story about bots. I had a similar situation. I used to have, you say you're a recovering WoW addict. I'm a recovering Lineage 2 addict.
Classic.
Yeah, so the ultimate of failure here in the States. It was definitely a dying game. But one of the things is it was rampant with bots all over the place. But, you know, NCSoft, and I have no insight into this, but being a player, the players in North America were just incensed over the fact that NCSoft would not do anything about the rampant botting in Lineage 2. And so there became the real players and then the botting players. And there was like a line dividing the two. But eventually, due to NCSoft's sort of complacency in the matter, eventually the legitimate players, in order to compete, because Lineage 2 is a damn hard game. Yeah, and so eventually to compete, they switched over to botting. So it's just interesting how something like that can completely take over the culture almost of your game.
What's the goal there, like, of doing something like what you describe of playing four characters with the same keyboard? Like, is that those characters are being farmed in some way to like sell the characters later, or that it's an easier game because you've got quadruple the attack strength? Or like, what's the game plan on someone doing that?
Ultimately, it's, in that case, four times the amount of farm, four times the amount of player or characters that you have that are max level. And when you want to do things like, probably a lot of these people, or at least in the case of Lineage 2, a lot of people were most interested in getting to max level, getting a lot of money so they can get the best gear, and then spending all of their time in these big, huge, awesome battles that Lineage 2 was amazingly good at. So in WoW, I don't know if that's the same feeling where I just do this so I can get gear to PvP or gear to raid, but it's probably the same reason.
Yeah, and just like when you're farming, you're just going around killing boars, or I guess if you're higher level, killing whatever elementals or something like that, collecting stuff from them. You can do it faster if you have five guys all in sync. And also you can sell the characters when they get to max level. But it was something that I don't think this is the main reason people do it, but I thought it was really hilarious when I saw it. I was playing PvP, which was a 3v3 teams with my brother and my dad, and we got online and we're playing various teams and whatever, and then we got against this one team, and it was one of these guys that was doing three simultaneous shamans. And it was just three of the same looking character doing the same thing, and we actually ended up winning because you're restricted by that all three of you people in your party can only do the exact same thing at the exact same time. But it was pretty hilarious that he had gone through all the levels, played, I don't know, 100 hours or something like that, in order to simultaneously try to fight people.
That is another level of dedication.
Yeah. So I sort of mentioned this, but I think it's worth a kind of digging in, or just kind of seeing if there is anything a little more underneath there. Shipping content every 2 weeks. Is there anything special that you've needed to do to adapt to being doing that? Because, you know, people will ship website updates every couple weeks or sometimes every week. But historically in, you know, game development, even like modern AAA online games, when a patch comes out, it's like, you know, there might be weeks of anticipation that like, oh, when is the next patch going to drop? And it's like, oh, it's on the test realms. It's coming soon. And then like, you know, they know they often launch on Tuesdays. So like for a few Tuesdays in a row, people will be like, oh, maybe the patch is coming. And you're shipping like every 2 weeks, just kind of like, is there anything in particular you need to do in order to make that feasible?
That is the understatement question of the year. Basically, the last year of my life was answering that question. And I recently gave a talk at GDC. Well, recently, I guess it was back in March, about this, where basically I like to split it up into the three things that we needed to change, which is, you know, how we were organized as a company. So getting 300 people to try and ship every 2 weeks is a feat of itself in both organization, and then the second thing, which is process. And then probably the most interesting of that is the third thing, which is technology. So what do you guys normally use? I assume Git.
Yes. But
yes,
as I understand it, Git doesn't deal with games very well because it keeps a copy of everything that ever happened on everyone's computer, and everything that ever happened in a game that's 20 gigabytes when it's done is a lot more than most people have space on their computer.
Yes, and when you have 300 people working on that, that ends up to be quite a few diffs in there. So we use Perforce, and one of the things that we did up to launch is we were all working in the same environment. And I'm sure that being a Git user, that might cause you to shudder. Everybody was checking into the same place. They were making the same build off of the same code. And that worked really well, actually, for launch. And there's something really powerful about, okay, guys, we're getting ready for, let's say, a beta test leading up to launch. Let's everyone put your hands up in the air. Let's work on getting this thing stable so that our players can play it in, let's say, 2 weeks. And then you bug fix for 2 weeks. It moves into a staging environment. And then, you know, the development environment or the main line opens back up and people can work in there as, you know, staging gets more and more stable, gets QA'd, and then eventually goes to live. And then before that, live wasn't live yet. So then live was made accessible by the player base. Now, flip that to being a live game. We originally set out at the launch of Guild Wars 2 to do monthly releases. And even doing monthly releases, that tests the bounds of what you can do. Because when you're trying to stabilize for one release, the other release is right behind it. And you're holding up the people developing for the next release while you're trying to stabilize the release that's currently going on. So it's extremely inefficient. Not to mention it leads to, unfortunately, a lot of programmers having to ifdef a whole bunch of their code depending on which release their code was going out in. So this is basically
shipping code where there's a bunch of code that's in the code that's not supposed to run yet because it's not ready yet. And if you've done it right, then it won't.
Yes. And if you've done it wrong, you'll find out right away. So there were a lot of problems. So eventually, and this isn't a new concept, but eventually we did, a branching system. But the thing that is hard with branching in games is not the code part of that. That's really easy. There are a bazillion solutions for that already. Perforce does it just fine. And the merging of that stuff is just fine. A programmer smart, they've dealt with a bazillion merges by the time, you know, they're working on a video game and shipping a video game. So they're very good at that. The thing where it gets hard is when you're talking about content and when you're talking about art. And so we had to build in mechanisms specifically to merge content and art. So that was really the biggest technological hurdle. So we were able to spin up, now we can spin up a branch. It's really a click button, and a whole team can have an entire environment to themselves that they can develop on, run builds on, and then ship it basically whenever they want. So we can have a team. It's not like everybody is targeted on this week, and then we ship it, and then they develop for a week, and we lock it down, and then they ship it again. Instead, we have one team targeting 2 weeks from now. We have a different team targeting a month from now. We have a different team targeting a month and a half from now. So it really allows us to sort of cascade through our teams depending on when their content is ready.
Which is the way that, like, most great software, I can't say most, but a lot of great software is when a moderately sized team works really cohesively on something. Getting 300 people all step at the same time is very challenging, especially when you're working on something creative. If you can do that and break them up into smaller teams that each one can have this sort of vision of, okay, this is what this real release that we're going to have in 8 weeks is going to be about, and they're focusing on that, then that probably unlocks a substantial amount of productivity.
Absolutely. And I don't know if people are familiar with agile development, but I mean, agile development really depends on people being able to ship stuff when it's ready and when it's done and when it's to the highest quality that it can be. And having a branching system like that is really necessary in order to facilitate that.
So that's interesting and completely conflicts with any way I've ever heard of any game being developed.
I think when you have the easy way to think about it is this, is that when you have 300 people working on a game, you can always have something going out the door. And, you know, and it's always a balance. It's not, I'm not going to say that we don't have deadlines or we don't have things that have release dates. But at the same time, you know, you do need to allow the creative process to flourish. You really do need to allow your designers and your artists and your programmers to hone in on what is fun. So it's always a balance, but really you're not going to have a successful game unless you're invested in the quality. And I think, I mean, there's no reason, or it's no wonder why Blizzard has been successful. Everybody knows it's because they focused on quality rather than deadlines. And the same thing for Valve. Valve, you know, releases when things are done. I won't even mention Half-Life 3.
I'm sure it'll be great.
I think it's not entirely true that that's different from how most games are developed. I mean, a lot of games, you know, games that don't have a big multiplayer ongoing release cycle, you certainly don't see that in public. But I would say internally, most large game teams these days are probably using a very similar structure to that of, you know, you have a central repository, you have some set of features that are going to get into a particular milestone, you know, that for a game that's going to be shipped out, a single player game that's going to be shipped out at some point in the future, the set of features in that is fixed, but the set of features milestone to milestone is shifting in exactly that same way. And so people are working on things and you have particular, you know, a particular branch that's targeting the milestone that's going out now. And you know, if you say like, well, we're doing monthly milestones, then people will work on stuff for 2 weeks. And then some of the team will keep working on features to the next milestone and other parts of the team will start stabilizing. And so I think you see it on a smaller scale in any large project, any large game project, just because of that, you know, that requirement of you're almost always, if you're, you know, if you've got anyone that you answer to, you have to be sending them periodic milestone builds for them to evaluate the progress. And they've got those exact same constraints that the regular releases do of they're on some fixed timetable. There's rarely a situation where you say, well, this particular feature absolutely has to be in by this release, but you've got to have some way of managing those ongoing changes.
Absolutely. I will say, having worked on the milestone side, and I'm sure you have as well, the quality of those are, you know, there's a little more leeway on that stuff than necessarily if you were shipping it live.
Yeah, for single player games, there's a lot of a pressure to fake it, right? Because you want to impress the publisher. And so you can say, well, oh, well, we can maybe squeeze this feature in that we're not sure is actually, you know, at the stability level, or there's some Potemkin village kind of aspects to it of things that are faked, but we want to demo it because we said we're going to have it by this time. And you can get away with that in a single player game because, you know, you're not shipping it out to the general public. As long as you can give the demo to the higher ups, then everything's fine for now. Whereas obviously the scale that you guys are dealing with, that's not really an option. You can't ship out something half-assed to try and impress the public. You've got to make sure that everything that goes out is at full quality. But yeah, I mean, you even in a milestone cycle, you certainly can't get away with shipping junk. You just can get away with shipping some stuff that's not quite as solid behind the scenes as it would appear from the demo.
Oh man, the milestone process between publishers and developers, that could be a whole nother talk.
Yeah, it's pretty broken, that whole setup.
It is very broken. I'm sure you have stories as well as I do.
We have an episode lined up in the future about crunch mode in development and all of the weird effects that seem to manifest, particularly in the games industry, about scheduling and overtime and things.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting calling back to, you mentioned Blizzard only shipping things when they're good. And I thought it was quite interesting, the news this week that Titan, which was their big anticipated MMO, that the, was going to be the follow-up to World of Warcraft that they'd never officially announced, but everyone was highly anticipating. And I was very curious about, I think 7 years they'd been working on it. They've officially said, you know what, we're canceling it. It's done. It's not going to, it just, apparently the news was that it wasn't that fun. So they're like, oh, well, we're Blizzard, so we can just can it.
It must have been an extremely hard decision. I, you know, just reading the few snippets of quotes from them, I could imagine being in the room where that decision was made. I mean, the loss aversion after 7 years must have been so strong and so difficult to overcome. Like, this is something, and really, I thought, I don't know if you read any of the quotes, but really, the rationale for killing it was very good. I think they made the right decision, which is, they don't want to identify as an MMO studio. And I think that's really smart. And I think I mentioned this before, which is, what is an MMO these days? And when you tie yourself to the MMO title, you're really, it triggers something in your mind, and it triggers a specific gameplay. It triggers a specific thing that you'll be doing, questing, raiding, talking to people, all of that stuff. And I could understand the reason for divorcing themselves from that.
Yeah, and it seemed like not necessarily, you know what we thought about? We don't want to make MMOs anymore. I mean, they had the most profitable MMO of all time, so they have at least some interest in potentially doing that, but that it, they sort of had this understanding that they're not a studio that makes MMOs and then they'll be as good as they will be. They're a studio that makes great games, and if it can be an MMO, then they would have done it, but that you know, their explorations were just not leading them down a path that it was going to be this incredible game that was going to be all the fun and all of the, you know, player satisfaction that they'd hoped.
Yeah, it's quite, I mean, it shows the discipline of the leadership group over there. I think it tells a lot about that studio in a positive light. I mean, or, you know, it shows the maturity of a studio that can do something like that. Also, obviously, they're making enough money where they have the luxury to do that. Yeah. But
you've got a big Scrooge McDuck style money vault that you can swim around in. Those calls are a lot easier to make.
Right. And I bring up Valve too, which is a little dishonest as well. I mean, when you have something like Steam, you have the luxury to make the decisions that you do. But it's still, at the same time, cutting a game, especially a game of 7 years, is never easy.
Yeah, so props to them. We'll raise a drink to the folks that worked on that. And I'm sure there was some great work that will eventually get merged into other stuff. Well, and leaked too, probably. It's always interesting hearing about that. Cool. So I think that's a good coverage of our scaling games topic and various neighboring topics. How can people find out more about you and what you're up to, Kristen?
The best way is probably to follow me on Twitter, and that is Elliptic, Elliptic.
All right. So everyone, go check that out and download Guild Wars 2, I believe, this week it is. Or at least this week as we record, although it'll be probably just ending as we go live. There's like a free demo on right now.
It's true. I didn't even remember that. Thank you. Yeah, there's a free trial going on right now. So I think it's on for the next week or so.
Yeah. So it goes till like October 4th or something like that. So depending on when this show goes live, you may have just missed it and you'll be like, oh, I'm going to have to buy this game now. I think people have heard enough about the philosophy that it's worth supporting people who are building games for gamers, as opposed to just trying to turn us into pay-to-win strategies and stuff. So,
thank you.
So thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We want to know what you think. So give us some feedback either on iTunes or sending us an email. And new this week, we also have Steam launched the ability for people to be curators, where you can actually, you know, follow on Steam a group that's posting specific game recommendations. And so we've started putting up on Steam games that either we've talked about on the show, we've recommended, or that people that have been on the show have been working on. So if you're interested, there's a link in the show notes for our Steam recommendations page. So check it out and see you next week. So have you had any time to play games when you're shipping every 2 weeks?
I do. I play a lot of Dota 2.
Right. You're in this recreational tournament.
Oh, yes, I am. It's a game dev tournament that was set up by Mitch over at IGN and Chris Floyd, who runs or is part of Indie Megabooth. And those two guys set this up, and we had 16 teams, and we're down to 8. We won our game last weekend, so we are one of those 8.
Awesome. So everyone who's on the teams more or less are either people making games or games journalism folks. And so I've been seeing sort of in my tweets at first it's just like, recreational, woo! And I'm like, what is that? But eventually pieced enough together in people's links and stuff like that. There's some folks from Gaslamp Games who are friends of the show, and Campo Santo folks, and yourself. So I've been seeing, as someone who is a completely incompetent Dota player, but I can at least appreciate other people having fun with it.
Yeah, actually, as of this talk today, they just dropped their brand new patch, which is a very huge overhaul of the game. So I was playing earlier today, and oh man, they changed a lot about the game, so it's a big deal.
Now Dota, that's another one of these MOBAs, like, yes. LOL is. Have I got my acronyms correctly?
I don't think you could say that with more detest in your voice. Is that one of those MOBAs?
No, I'm being sarcastic. We actually, Alan and I played League of Legends. When was that? Like a couple months ago.
Yeah.
We were supposed to do a show about it that ended up not coming together for some reason. And so neither of us had ever played League of Legends. And so we just like downloaded it of an evening and played online together. And it was actually quite fun. Like I always sort of, I don't even look down on isn't the right term, but it never seemed like something that would appeal to me from what I'd heard about it. But trying it out, it's like, yeah, this is something I could see myself getting into if I still had the time in general to sink time into multiplayer games.
Yeah, I hear that. I think it's one of those things where you hear it and you know enough about it to know that it has a high barrier to entry, and that pushes a lot of people away. I think one of the great things that LOL did for the genre is make it more accessible. And because everybody is playing it, you meet somebody. Walking down in Seattle, you see people with League of Legends shirts all over the place. And it makes you realize that, man, everybody is playing this game. And there's no, if you were just a random person, you'd be like, oh, yeah, maybe I should give that a try because I saw, you know, that 8-year-old kid with a League of Legends shirt. Maybe I can do it.
Yeah. And I was pleasantly surprised about how much we were able to actually play, because there's a pretty negative association with. Because the game mechanic of if someone on your team sucks, it's worse than nothing. It just means that you don't want people who suck on your team, and no one wants people who suck on their team. But in this game genre, it's particularly bad for that. So, but League of Legends, at least in the like ultra noob bin that it placed us in, based on our having just created accounts, we were able to learn and have fun and compete, and it actually kind of worked. So you said that the game's changed dramatically. Is that like, you're someone who's actually playing competitive Dota, and so to you, they're like, this constant used to be 1.75, and now it's 1.7, and so I can like just barely catch up to someone who I couldn't previously? Or this is like new game mechanics, new maps, new rules?
So not new maps, but things like they introduced a new rune. So a rune is this thing that you get, this, I hate to call it an item, this temporary buff, I guess, that you can get when you're in the river. And they introduced a brand new one of those. They changed the maps. So instead of the routes that you used to have, you have different routes now. So I think yes, noob level changing. Maybe a noob wouldn't instantly recognize it, but definitely to people at the professional level, this completely changes up a lot of their play style. So the pro level play will be changed drastically by these changes, and not in the I tweak this knob to be 1 millisecond faster, but like now instead of running this way, I have to take an entirely different route and I need to watch my back from over here.
So it changes the feel.
Yeah.
And you always need those competitive games need to be changing in that way, because otherwise it just becomes one dominant strategy, right?
It's kind of remarkable how much like a little tweak like that. I had something like that happen to me in the latest Hearthstone update, because I've been playing a hunter a lot and they nerfed one of the hunter cards in the most recent Hearthstone update. And like, I agree with their call on it, but it totally changes the feel of my current deck for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, if you're really into a game, those balance updates, you pour through them. You really care about them. I mean, we see the exact same thing on Guild Wars 2. Whenever we release a balance update, people really want to know every little thing that's changed because it's going to affect them.
Yeah, I followed that a bit in WoW when I was PvPing, and also in StarCraft 2 as well, when you see a patch notes, the ones where it's like, okay, this someone, some other class that you don't play has changed in this way, it's not as fascinating. But if it's your class, and it'll be like, yeah, we increased the duration of this ability that you never use from 1.1 to 1.2. And then I'm kind of like, maybe I should try that again. I never used that one.
Maybe I should be using that.
Yeah, it's like
maybe
10% better.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
So changing gears with something that's sort of like, you know, looking at games, one of the games that has sort of been on the holiday radar for reviewers and things, but I was completely ignoring, is this Middle Earth game. Have either of you seen anything? Shadow of Mordor?
Like Assassin's Creed in Middle Earth, basically.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
Yeah, basically.
Little known fact, when I was at Monolith, we were working on that game.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So I had written it off because it was a Middle Earth game, and I don't know, I just assumed it couldn't be good in the same way that I wrote off Batman Arkham Asylum, because I'm like, oh yeah, Batman game is just going to be bad because they're not going to do anything with the IP that is going to be worth it or whatever. And then it turned out that game was awesome. And according to today, I'm not sure if it was midnight Eastern time, but just the reviews have started to roll out, and I looked at three random ones because I saw the Polygon one was 9.5 out of 10, and then IGN was like 9.3, and then the other one I saw was like 9.7 or something. So it was getting like pretty amazing reviews. So
yeah, I've heard good things. I've heard good things from people that have played it. Obviously, I mean, the game that I worked on is, I'm sure, very, very different. They have the thing that I've mostly been reading about is the thing that they have called the Nemesis system. Have you guys heard about this?
No. How does that work?
It's where you try to kill like some orc warlord, and people will have to excuse my Lord of the Rings fiction is a little rusty. No Silmarillion for me. You try to kill an orc warlord, and if you don't succeed, you can watch the orc warlord rise through the ranks, and he or female orc warlord as well, she would can send people to you specifically or something to deal with that, but you can watch them rise due to the fact that they beat you in battle, and you can go back and it remembers the fact that you had a previous battle and they gained something good out of beating you.
That's so funny, because so many RPGs or long-running story games have the opposite, like the bad guy will beat you but not kill you for some reason in the first chapter, just so he's like, "Mwah, you're a puny, it's not even worth killing you," and then you rise up to like cause them problems. But it's fun that they're like, let's have it the other way around.
Yeah, I think it works in the reverse as well, whereas if you kill them, then you completely decapitate this, you know, whole section of the hierarchy and, you know, in that section. But it's very, very interesting. It's something unique that is in this game only. So I'm interested to play it.
That's cool.
definitely looks like it's in my sweet spot for like jumping off roofs and killing people. So if the two actual Assassin's Creed games that are coming out this year don't fulfill my desires for that, I'm definitely going to check it out.
That's cool. When we met at EXO, you mentioned a little bit about that you do some game development or have done some game development on the side. Do you have any side projects boiling?
I have, well, as always, things rolling around in my head. One of the things that actually that I'm currently most of my free time is supporting is actually my boyfriend's indie game. He is an indie developer and he has a game called Every Book Ever, and you can just go to everybookever.com. And have you guys played Balderdash before?
Yeah.
Yep.
So this is like Balderdash, but for books, where you're writing the first sentence of a book, where all you have from that book is the title and the description. So everybody writes the first sentence, or what they think would be a plausible first sentence to this book, and then you get a list of all the plausible first sentences, along with somewhere in that list is the real sentence, and you try and find out which one's the real sentence.
And so you're trying to, like, make ridiculous but not too ridiculous suggestions.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends, right? Like, you, maybe it's me, but I've always thought of third sentences as something that, you know, it's just, you know, it's the first interaction. You want it to be really good. I'm sure an author spends a lot of time thinking about their first sentence. And what you realize in playing this game, nope, that is not the case. The best of times, the worst of times, that's about as good as it gets. And it's all downhill from there. I think my favorite one is yum.
That's the whole first sentence.
In quotes, yum.
Nice.
So is this like a party style, like everyone gets together and plays at the same time, or is it like an asynchronous, like play by email style
turn? It's asynchronous game, but actually when I go home to my parents' place, we just after dinner will load this up on my dad works for Microsoft, so we'll load it up on Surfaces, and you know, everybody will get their own computer or on their phone, and we'll just play a few games. So it's asynchronous, but you can play it together in person as well. So it's pretty fun.
So speaking of first sentences, I'll link it in the show notes. But there's actually a contest called the Bulwer-Lytton
Fiction Contest.
I know it.
Which is a contest to see can you compose the worst possible opening sentence of a book, which does not exist necessarily, but you just submit one sentence, and then each year they have the worst sentences. So I've just brought it up. This year's winners were recently announced. Just a random one example bad sentence. After years of Dame Gothel's tyranny, Rapunzel was only seconds from freedom until, with an agonized scream, the prince plunged to his death in the thorns below, grasping a handful of detached blonde strands, the golden hair having been irreparably weakened by the deficiency of vitamins B3, B6, and B7 in his love's new celiac-friendly diet.
Oh my goodness, that is so fantastic.
The contest's namesake, Edward Bulwer-Lytton, is of course the guy behind probably the most famous opening sentence after "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times," which is, "It was a dark and stormy night."
Ah.
Right.
And in fact, the "it was a dark and stormy night" part is actually the good portion of that sentence. Here's the whole quote on that. "It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the streets. For it is London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flames of the lamps that struggled against the darkness.
Wow.
I think we can agree that that is a pretty terrible opening sentence.